Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP monthly training series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Today we have Joe Kachera, the Senior Assistant Attorney General from the Wyoming Attorney General's Office, and Aaron Hockman, Chief Trial and Appellate Counsel from the Wyoming Guardian Ad Litem Division. They're here today to provide an overview of 2017-18 Wyoming Supreme Court decisions related to child welfare law. Thank you, Jill and Aaron.
Thank you, Whitney.
Thank you.
As Whitney said, we're going to provide just an overview of some of the case law that's come out in 2017-2018. We may reference back to a couple of older cases in 2015 and 16 because of the effect they had on some of the newer cases. And Aaron and I will just be basically going back and forth on these cases, with Aaron going to discuss some consent decree cases first of all. So take it away, Aaron.
Thank you, Jill. Our first case up is N. Re. DJS-Y, 2017, Wyoming 54. This was the third consent decree case that we refer to as a trilogy. The first case occurred in 2015, N. Re. CDR. The second case in February of 2016, N. Re. CRA. Taken together, the trilogy says that consent decrees are contracts between the parties. Therefore, they are governed by contract law. The party's intent is contained within the four corners of the document. The statutory scheme on consent decrees provides the framework within which a consent decree can be entered. A consent decree is for a period of 6 months, with the possibility of one extension for an additional 6 months for good cause. There is no such thing as a 12-month consent decree to begin with. There is no possibility of a second, third, fourth, etc., extension beyond the initial 1 year. In the DJS-Y case, the consent decree had expired on its face after a period of 6 months. The mother in that case filed a motion to dismiss the matter, citing the expiration of the contract. The state responded by seeking to extend the consent decree. The Supreme Court found that because it was a contract, reinforcing its two previous cases, that once it expired by the terms of the contract, the court had lost jurisdiction and there was no possibility of any extension. In this case, the children had not yet been returned home to the mother, so the court had actually extended the consent decree. This was a reversal by the Supreme Court, indicating that the court had lost its jurisdiction, and even though the children weren't returned home, the terms of the contract govern. Therefore, if you're in a situation like this and you need to revoke or extend a consent decree, it must be done before the consent decree expires.
Okay. Next, I'm going to talk about some cases on permanency hearings, and again, just to reflect back, as we call it, the case that started it all, NRA GC, provided that requirement that parents may request if the permanency goal is recommended to change from reunification, that parents may request an evidentiary permanency hearing. And if they fail to make that request, they basically have waived that ability and the permanency hearing will not be an evidentiary permanency hearing. So after the NRA GC case, we are seeing a lot of appeals from permanency hearings. And the couple that I want to discuss right now and then later on in the process, we'll discuss a couple more. But the first one is NRA LMHB. The site is 401 Pacific 3rd. 949. This is a September 2017 case. And in that case, mother raised a due process argument arguing that the juvenile court's delays in issuing adjudication and disposition orders and its delay in issuing a permanency order after the permanency hearing violated the mother's due process right. And also the mother argued that the court's use of her actions in the juvenile case during the period before adjudication and disposition violated her due process rights because there was no order mandating case plan compliance during the period. And she had no notice that her actions during that period could be used against her. Initially, this case, the Supreme Court was very direct about the delays within the juvenile case and basically stated that the delays in the case were unacceptable and contrary to the child's best interest. And I think that's an important holding for everybody who's involved in this process to look at making sure that the time frames within the Child Protection Act and within juvenile court proceedings are met and kept up with, because again, delay does affect the child's right to permanency and the child's best interest. In this case, despite their concerns with the delays in the matter, the court determined, and the state had argued that the mother had waived her due process claims because she actually agreed with the permanency goal. She just didn't agree with who of adoption. She just didn't agree with who the adoptive parents might be. And the Supreme Court did determine and held that the mother waived any claim that the permanency order was entered in violation of her due process rights, and waived any claim that the permanency order that modified the permanency goal from reunification to adoption was inadequate because it failed to make statutory required findings with specificity. The court also held that the juvenile court's failure to specifically designate adoptive parents of mother's choosing in the permanency order did not impermissibly infringe upon her residual parental rights, that she still maintained those rights. Her rights had not been terminated. And the court also held that the juvenile court did not abuse its discretion by refusing to designate the adoptive parents in the permanency order. The next case that I want to discuss was an earlier permanency hearing case, an April 2017 case. It's in the interest of DT and NT, minor children, 391 Pacific 3rd, 1136. One of the issues, the mother claimed that her due process rights were violated at the permanency hearing because the children weren't present at the permanency hearing. And this permanency hearing occurred within a month after the change in the juvenile court rules and the change in the statutes, which required that children be present at permanency hearings, and if they're not present, that the court make a determination that it's appropriate that they not be present at the hearing. The district court or the Supreme Court found a presumption that children be present at the juvenile court and the permanency hearing, unless the court makes that determination that they should not be present and should make that determination prior to the hearing. In this particular case, nobody brought up the issue until the end of the permanency hearing when the court made reference to the fact of that requirement and then found that it was not necessary that the children be at the hearing. So the takeaway from this case is really that determination needs to be made before the permanency hearing and that there is a presumption that the children shall be present at the permanency hearing in most cases. The Supreme Court also found that the mother was provided due process and that the finding of the permanency hearing was supported by sufficient evidence to move forward to changing that permanency goal to adoption.
Next up, we're going to cover some parental contact and or grandparent rights and issues. The Supreme Court issued a decision in December 2017 in the matter of the adoption of SSO, 2017 Wyoming 142. In this case, the issue on appeal was whether RB, SSO's biological father, had standing to challenge the adoption of SSO. The Supreme Court found that RB did not have standing to challenge. RB's parental rights had been previously terminated in a separate proceeding through a termination order of any unknown fathers. The Supreme Court found that this was a collateral attack on the termination order and that without standing, it was not proper for father to try and collaterally attack the orders of a different case in the adoption. Another adoption issue in the matter of the adoption of MMM, 2018, Wyoming 60, decided in June of 2018. The Supreme Court found that the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that an incarcerated mother had not willfully abandoned her child or willfully failed to pay child support pursuant to the adoption statute 1-22-110 in a contested adoption. The takeaway of this is really that incarceration alone does not make a parent willfully abandoning their child, or that incarceration's limitations on a parent's ability to provide child support in and of itself enough to sustain a contested adoption. Turning to a termination of parental rights case, in the matter of the TPR to KGS, 2017 Wyoming 2, the father in this matter had appealed the termination of his parental rights, challenging the sufficiency of the evidence under Wyoming Statute 14-2-309A3 and 5. The Supreme Court found there was sufficient evidence, but did note that the father had had minimal contact with the minor child, KGS, throughout her life. That minimal contact was enough or sufficient and goes to the question of parental unfitness. To me, one of the more interesting subnotes on this case was father had challenged whether he had received due process because MDT notes and settings had not been sent to him or says they weren't sent to him through the mail in the juvenile case. Again, the Supreme Court said that that was a collateral attack on a separate proceeding. Father's due process concerns with with what had occurred in the juvenile proceeding were not appropriately brought on an appeal of a termination of parental rights. Separate and distinct proceedings, so you've got to appeal correctly depending on what case it is. I like to make a note at this point because we talked about in the matter of the adoption of SSO, that minor child has had several cases in the juvenile court, in the district court, juvenile proceedings, TPR proceedings, adoption proceedings, that in her earlier appeal, In Re SO 2016 Wyoming 99, the Supreme Court did seem to overturn or at least modify their holding from the In Re JW decision. It's a very important case to note because in In Re SO, the Supreme Court notes that the best interests of the child may trump a familial placement. So in that case, the grandparents had challenged and wanted SO placed with them. The Supreme Court said no, that the bond with the foster parents was more important than the grandparents and the familial connections there. So it's just such a critical case. We'd like to make sure that people still keep that on their radar.
The next case we want to talk about kind of keys into that In Re SO decision. This was a case in the interest of EHD. It is 2017 Wyoming 134. It's a case that came out in November of 2017. And this was an appeal from an attempt by grandparents to intervene in the juvenile court proceeding relating to their grandchild. They moved to intervene. They also moved to be appointed to the multidisciplinary team and to have the minor child placed with them. And the juvenile court denied their motions. Grandparents appealed, arguing that the juvenile court abused its discretion by denying their motion to intervene, and actually argued that they had a right to intervene in the juvenile court proceedings. The Supreme Court held that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying the grandparents' motion to intervene, that there was no statutory right to intervene by grandparents in a juvenile court proceeding. In this case, as in the SO case, this was not a case where the grandparents weren't aware of the juvenile court proceedings. And in both the SO case and this case, their attempts to intervene and their attempts to get placement of the child occurred well into the juvenile court proceedings when the permanency goal was being recommended to change from reunification to adoption. One of the things in the EHD case that the Supreme Court said is that the grandparents were no stranger to this case and that they were aware of the proceedings, but substantially delayed in their attempt to intervene in the proceeding. And the grandparents in the EHD case did cite to the JW case that Aaron referenced, however ignored the In Re SO case in arguing their position. And as I said, the Supreme Court said this is not a case where appellants were unaware of the situation, that they were aware of the situation from the time the neglect proceedings were initiated. Because the motion to intervene was appropriately denied, the grandparents were not parties to the proceeding, and thus the court found that they lacked standing to raise a challenge to the trial court's denial of the request to be appointed to the multidisciplinary team and to have the child placed with them. The next case is in the matter of GAC. This is a termination of parental rights case. This decision came out in June of 2017, and there are a couple of important issues in this case. One had to do with the role of the guardian ad litem. The parent in the termination case filed a motion and argued that the guardian ad litem should not be allowed to fully participate in the termination proceedings and should take a very limited role in those proceedings because the child was not a party, and basically all the GAL was there to do was to argue about the best interests of the child after the termination had occurred. The trial court determined that no, the guardian ad litem had the right to fully participate in the evidentiary proceedings in the termination action, and that the statutory provisions setting forth the requirements for termination of parental rights include factors directly related to the child's well-being, and specifically under the grounds in the case, which were the A3 ground and the A5 ground, the court said, it is hard to conceive how the GAL's duty to represent the child as to those factors if the GAL's participation were curtailed in the matter urged by the parent. And so this case stands for the holding that the guardian ad litem is allowed and, in fact, is required to fully participate in termination of parental rights proceedings. The court also held that the guardian ad litem did not fail, this was a jury case, did not fail to inform the jury of the child's wishes to remain with mother or improperly ask the jury to decide the case based on the child's best interest rather than the statutory factors, that again, those statutory factors and the best interests are obviously and intricately entwined with one another, and that the GAL performed their duties in the case appropriately. One of the other issues in this case related to discovery rules and disclosure of experts' witnesses. The mother alleged that the department did not meet the requirements relating to disclosure or designation of expert witnesses, but the court determined that the expert witnesses in this matter were treating providers. They were not specially retained or employed to provide expert testimony, and that the district court properly denied the parents' motion to exclude the expert testimony on that basis. Then additionally, the mother raised an argument as to privilege relating to information from her mental health providers. The trial court determined that those mental health providers could testify as to the information, and that there were reasons to allow the disclosure of that information. The Supreme Court went a little further and again indicated that mother had said, well, I had released the information initially, but now I'm pulling back that release. The Supreme Court indicated that in prior case law, they have stated that a subsequent revocation of a release will not prevent testimony about the information previously disclosed pursuant to that release. The court also indicated that even without the express waivers, the evidence was admissible under 14.3.2.10 because it did relate to the child and negligence of the child. And then the next case I want to talk about is a case relating to reasonable efforts. This is a case where the father appealed the determination in a permanency hearing that the department had not made reasonable efforts towards reunification with him. The permanency plan had changed to adoption. The Supreme Court affirmed the district court, which found that there were reasonable efforts and that the plan should change, and held that the Department of Family Services did make adequate efforts to reunify the father with his son without success, which is required to change the permanency plan for the children to adoption. This is a case where two permanency hearings were actually held. In the first permanency hearing, the juvenile court made a determination that there had not been reasonable efforts, not due to any actions of the department, but because of the father's situation in being incarcerated for basically the entire time that the children were in care. However, at the second permanency hearing, the juvenile court determined that the department did make those reasonable efforts, that father really just did not comply with them, and that he had not pursued the opportunities he had for rehabilitative services and communication with his children.
Turning to some procedural cases, we have In the Interest of NP, 2017, Wyoming 18, from February of 2017. In this case, the mother had challenged whether the juvenile court had appropriately denied her motion for a jury trial. The facts are the mother had not formally filed a written demand for a jury trial, but instead had left a voicemail with the judge's judicial assistant and orally indicated she wished for a jury trial. The Supreme Court found that that was not a proper demand and that a parent must demand in writing, filed with the clerk of court within 10 days, as required by the statute, an appropriate demand for a jury trial in a juvenile neglect proceeding. The mother additionally challenged whether there was sufficient evidence to have found her neglectful. The Supreme Court found that there was evidence. The background lurking in this case was mother's appellate counsel had filed for an Anders brief stating to the Supreme Court or implying that there were no appealable issues. The Supreme Court had denied the request for Anders, noting that they have not extended Anders procedures to juvenile neglect proceedings. Compare and contrast that to the case of in the matter of the termination of parental rights to BMW, MEW, and SFW, 2018, Wyoming 44, where the Supreme Court reaffirmed that Anders procedures can be utilized in appeals from termination of parental rights cases. In other words, if you're in appellate practice, Anders procedures under all the standard rules from Anders v. California are applicable, but in an appeal from a juvenile proceeding, they are not. Turning to a very interesting case, it's an appeal from a criminal contempt action, Brown versus the State of Wyoming, 2017, Wyoming 45. The mother had been charged in the district court with criminal contempt for failure to follow a juvenile court order. Mother entered a conditional plea in the matter and appealed several issues to the Supreme Court. The first being whether or not the district court had criminal contempt powers over a person's failure to follow orders of the juvenile court. It's important to remember, and the Supreme Court notes here, that even though the district court and the juvenile court are very likely the same judge sitting in the same courtroom, they are not the same court. There is a statutory distinction between the two. And in this case, the district court does have concurrent jurisdiction with the juvenile court over criminal contempt arising from failure to follow orders of the juvenile court. The takeaway from that is that it's very important to note what court you are in. In other words, what does the caption on your pleading say? Are you filing it in the district court or are you filing it in the juvenile court? The Supreme Court notes that these two courts have concurrent jurisdiction over criminal contempt. The juvenile court has both civil and criminal contempt powers. However, the distinction being whichever court you file it in may change some of the procedural details. In the juvenile court, you're still going to be following the juvenile procedure rules. How that works in relation to a criminal contempt, not entirely clear. So as a matter for defense attorneys fighting a contempt, or for a prosecutor bringing a contempt, be very clear and specific about where you want this to proceed. Keeping in mind prior precedent that criminal contempt does require the filing of a separate action. It is not filed in the open juvenile case. It is a brand new criminal charge that is brought against the failing party. In this case, the mother had also, through her public defender, sought access to the juvenile court record and file. The district court judge had denied that request. The Supreme Court said that that was inappropriate and that the mother's attorney, public defender, was entitled to access the juvenile court file, even though it's confidential, in order to appropriately mount a defense. Turning to some termination of parental rights procedural issues, In Re EMM, MRM, and GRM, 2018 Wyoming 36, the Supreme Court continued its jurisprudence, noting that when a parent is in default, the normal civil rules regarding default apply, and that the district court has discretion in denying or granting a motion to set aside the entry of default. In this case, the mother specifically challenged the first prong of the test for setting aside the entry of default. From a prior case, the Supreme Court has indicated that the Department of Family Services is prejudiced in the granting of a motion to set aside the entry of default because the department has an obligation to obtain permanency for the child. Mother challenged that in this case, claiming that that would always mean the district court could never set aside an entry of default because the department is always prejudiced. So that prong is always in favor of the department. The Supreme Court indicated that while the department is prejudiced, that is just one of the three factors of the test. And the district court, in its discretion, can weigh that against the other factors in making its determination. Turning to another case that should be somewhat familiar if you've been paying attention here, in the matter of the TPR to AM-LR and TCG, 2018 Wyoming 76, the Supreme Court again reaffirmed that if you have a problem with the actions or procedures of the juvenile court, you must raise that on an appeal from the juvenile court. In this case, the parent challenged the termination of parental rights order, claiming that the juvenile court had messed things up. Supreme Court said that's a collateral attack. Repeatedly here, the Supreme Court is saying, pay attention to what case you're appealing your problems from. You can't collaterally challenge the actions of a different court or a different case in a different appeal. So just it's a practice question of make sure you're appealing the right question from the right court.
The next case that we want to talk about is In Re ASA. It's 2018 Wyoming 5. This was a January 2018 case. It's a termination of parental rights case. A father's rights were terminated under four of the five grounds alleged in the petition, and he appealed both on the sufficiency of the evidence, but also he argued that the Department of Family Services had failed to comply with its rules and regulations and had actually made a motion for judgment as a matter of law in the district court, which was denied by the district court, arguing that the termination should be dismissed because the department had failed to follow its rules and regulation. The rule that he was asserting the department had failed to follow was instigating and getting a case plan in place within 60 days of the children coming into foster care. The Supreme Court upheld the determination of the district court and determined that the person alleging a violation of a rule must show that how the rule violation denied due process or how the rule violation violated a fundamental right. In this particular case, the Supreme Court said that the department violated one rule. The case plan was approximately 45 days late in being filed. Part of the reason for that was difficulty in getting the father to actually come in and approve and sign off on the case plan. But the Supreme Court said that failure to follow one rule was a violation that was minimal in nature, and there was nothing within that violation that showed a denial of due process or violated the parent's fundamental right. With respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, the court again reiterated that when there are multiple grounds for termination, the department need only be successful and prove termination under one ground. The court discussed in detail one of the grounds, but found that there was sufficient evidence to support the termination of parental rights. The next case that I want to talk about is the case of N. Ray ECH. This was an appeal from a juvenile court proceeding. The site is 2018, Wyoming 83. This case came out in July of 2018, and it's had some very significant effect on practice in the field. In this particular case, the father appealed, asserting that his due process rights were violated because he was not appointed an attorney or advised of his right to counsel the first time that he appeared before the court. This was a non-custodial, and some use the term non-offending, parent. It was at the permanency hearing where these issues were raised. But the holding from the court is that a non-alleged parent, a non-offending parent, must be advised of their right to a counsel and appointed counsel upon request in every case, and that the burden is actually on the court to verify the financial condition of the parent. And so in those cases where you have a parent who does not have allegations in the petition, that does not mean that that parent does not get advice of his right to counsel and upon request and showing the appropriate indigency does not get appointed counsel. And so the practice should be to do that. Now, the court did conclude this violations, they were raised for the first time on appeal, and so the court did not reverse the decision of the district or of the juvenile court in this matter. The parent also argued that he was entitled to be present at the hearing. father was not able to be present and argued that the statute requires his actual presence. The court determined that no, he has to have the opportunity to appear in some matter, but that due process must be evaluated in the light of the process received throughout the proceedings. It's not a technical conception with a fixed content, and that the court, by permitting the father to appear by telephone while his counsel was present in the courtroom, that the father was afforded due process, and he had the opportunity to be heard in a meaningful manner in this case. Case that I want to talk about is actually the precursor, I guess I'll say, of a case we talked about a little bit ago, the JBNT LW case that we talked about, the permanency hearing. In this case, which was issued in March of 2017, and it is in the interest of JBNT LW, 390 Pacific 3rd, 357, 2017, Wyoming 26. The father appealed the adjudication that he was neglectful of his children and argued that he could not be neglectful of his children because he was in jail at the time the petition was filed and he did not have the physical custody or control of the children at the time the state alleged neglectful behavior. The juvenile court did adjudicate him as having neglected his children, and the Supreme Court determined that a father could be found to be a neglectful parent even though he did not have physical custody or control of the children when the neglect occurred. The case also includes a thorough discussion and interpretation of the phrase of who is a person responsible for a child's welfare under the statute. And then the next case that I want to talk about, it just briefly, it was an appeal from, again, a permanency hearing. The appeal was dismissed because the Supreme Court found that the appellant did not adhere to the Wyoming Rules of Appellate Procedure and failed to present a cogent argument or pertinent authority to support their claims. That case is In Re DW and KW, 395 Pacific 3rd, 184. I'll let you talk about it. Yes. And then we have a couple of new cases late in 2018 that we want to talk about, and Aaron will take the first one of those, and I will take the second one.
In late October 2018, the Supreme Court issued the decision In the Interest of V.S. This was an appeal from the juvenile court, and in this appeal, the father challenged whether his due process rights were violated by the juvenile court when it did not secure his attendance or testimony at a permanency hearing. It took judicial notice of the juvenile court file and allowed offers of proof rather than sworn witnesses to make statements. In other words, this is an appeal from an order changing permanency from family reunification to adoption. In this case, the father had been incarcerated for the majority of the child's life, up and until shortly before the permanency hearing in November of 2017. Reviewing the issue under a plain error standard, as it was not challenged before the juvenile court, the Supreme Court held that the juvenile court did not violate father's due process rights in this circumstance. The father had made arrangements to appear by telephone for the permanency hearing. He had been represented by counsel and had demanded an evidentiary permanency hearing. When the father failed to appear at the evidentiary permanency hearing, after being called by the court and no answer being had by the father on his phone, the juvenile court found father in default. The state requested to make an offer of proof rather than going through with a full evidentiary hearing and putting on witnesses. His counsel did not object to the offers of proof rather than sworn testimony, and the court proceeded. The court took judicial notice of the entirety of the juvenile court file. It heard from the state and the GAL, and it gave father's counsel an opportunity to make his own offer of proof, contrary to the state or the GAL. Based upon these circumstances, the Supreme Court found that there was no plain error committed by the juvenile court. It noted that this procedure is appropriate in the context of a non-evidentiary hearing, and father's failure to appear did and could be considered a waiver of his demand for an evidentiary permanency hearing. The court noted and reaffirmed the Wyoming Rules of Evidence that note that the rules of evidence do not apply at a permanency hearing, and so the juvenile court is allowed and entitled to consider things that may have hearsay as long as it's still probative, truthful, and reliable. The father in this case also challenged whether the juvenile court was required to do something more than to simply call him on his phone. And the Supreme Court essentially said that that issue is not wasn't entirely ripe in this case for further commentary. The father also did question the reasonable efforts provided by the Department of Family Services to reunify the family. And in this case, the Supreme Court made it very clear that this father, who had no relationship with the child, was entitled to something different than the mother whom the child was taken from. The department has a reasonable effort to preserve and reunify the family. The Supreme Court noted that the father in this case was not removed from the father, so there was nothing to reunify between the father and the child, and there was nothing to preserve. There was no relationship. So it raises some interesting new questions that I think we'll all see across the state trickling up as to what exactly that means moving forward for absent parents that are required by law to be brought into these cases, but exactly what reasonable efforts looks like and how that plays with permanency planning. Is the implication of this case that there's some new permanency plan of family unification? I don't know the answer to that, but that's lurking in the reading of this case.
And the final case that we want to talk about today is a case that was issued in December of 2018. It is 2018 Wyoming 140 in the matter of the adoption of LMHB, which should be an acronym that's familiar to you from the permanency hearing case that we talked about earlier. This was a petition for adoption that was filed by the former foster parents of the child. The Department of Family Services had moved to dismiss the adoption petition for failure to comply with the adoption statutes. The district court did dismiss the adoption petition for that failure to comply with the adoption statutes. The Supreme Court upheld the determination of the district court. There is a lengthy discussion of jurisdiction in this case, as the department had argued at the appellate level that the adoption court had lacked jurisdiction because of the failures to comply with the adoption statute, and so the Supreme Court lacked jurisdiction. The Supreme Court held that no, there was jurisdiction to hear the case, and again, a lengthy discussion surrounding that jurisdiction. The court did back away from a broad application of the term jurisdiction, and to the extent prior case law gave the impression that failures of this kind led to the court lacking jurisdiction, did overrule that prior case law. There was also a lengthy discussion of standing and the difference between prudential standing and statutory standing, and how that lack of standing applied to jurisdiction. The court said that the prudential standing does require an examination of the facts and whether the particular plaintiff has a cause of action under the statute, so that cannot be jurisdictional, as well as statutory standing. The appropriate method with respect to whether or not there is statutory standing is then a dismissal for failure to state a claim, again, not subject matter jurisdiction. The Supreme Court did determine that the former foster parents did lack standing because the adoption statute specifically requires that a person filing a petition for adoption files that petition when the child is in their home. And in this particular case, the child was not in the home of the person filing the petition for adoption at the time they filed their petition. The Supreme Court also determined that the district court appropriately dismissed the petition for failure to comply with the adoption statutes because the petition did not include the required consents and relinquishments that were required by statute. There were five categories of documents which the adoption statute requires shall be filed with a petition for adoption. And in this particular case, the department argued and the court agreed that the department's consent and relinquishment was required to be filed with the petition because the department had exclusive legal custody of the child through their temporary custody of the child from the juvenile court action, which they maintained at the time this adoption was filed, and that because of that, the department's relinquishment was required, and that requirement did not infringe on the mother's residual parental rights because the mother still had the opportunity to determine to consent to the adoption. One other thing, just briefly, just a reminder that there were changes to the rules of procedure for the juvenile court, which became effective in June of 2018, that one of those changes under Rule 2A is that there must be a filing of a juvenile petition to initiate proceedings. You can't have a petition for shelter care, protective custody, or temporary placement, and then later file a neglect petition. You must file a juvenile neglect petition to initiate those proceedings. Again, the reiteration of the presence of the child at permanency hearing, excusal but only by court order no less than 10 days before the hearing, and an encouragement that the child be present at all other hearings. Further, under Rule 2E, written notice is required by the county or district attorney to the parents, guardians, custodian, foster parents, pre-adoptive parents, or relative caregivers of the hearings in this matter. Rule 2F requires that, and it's kind of interesting because it requires a request for hearing to ensure the timeliness under Title 14. And some of these changes obviously are in response to some of the case law that we've talked about to you today, but requires that all counsel, GALs, parents, attorneys, and district and county attorneys are required to file those requests for hearings in a timely manner. And then the final change related to discovery at the Department of Family Services records. The rule continues to require a demand for discovery of Department of Family Services records through the state, but adds an ongoing duty to disclose 5 days prior to any MDT or hearing until dismissal of the case. So that's all we have for you today, and we'd be happy to answer, if we can, any questions that have been posed.
Thank you so much, Erin and Jill, for the informative blog talk. I don't see any questions at this time, but we really appreciate the update, and I know that helps a lot of us out. Just to give you all a quick update, on April 17th, we'll be having a special blog talk that's not on our regular blog talk schedule regarding what you need to know about the Central Registry. And our next regularly scheduled blog talk is on February 14th at noon. It'll be discussing teamwork in juvenile courts. I don't see any questions at this time, so again, thank you so much for your time, Jill and Erin. I really, really appreciate it.
All right, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.